I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Naif al-Mutawa, founder of The 99, a comic series with superheroes inspired by the Quran. The series includes comic books, a theme park in Kuwait, and a TV series. The superheroes in The 99 were created with the intention of providing youth in the Muslim world with positive role models. The goal is to improve people's self-perception by using archetypes from Islamic culture and to have the messages resonate internationally. Welcome.
Thank you.
Prior to starting The 99, you were a clinical psychologist working at Bellevue with victims of political torture. How did your interest in political torture develop?
I didn't choose it. It kind of chose me. I graduated college and went back to Kuwait where Saddam's army had just pulled out a couple years before, and so there are a lot of people who had gone through traumatic stress, and so part of my training there as a young psychologist was with those problems. And that led me to get into a graduate program that focused on that, and then when I applied for externships as part of my program, I became more of an asset to a place that had those kinds of clients.
When you were dealing with victims of political torture in Bellevue in the United States, where were they coming from?
So because I speak Arabic, my patients came out of Arab prisons. But there are people there from all over the world, just that I didn't speak the other languages.
You also have an MBA from Columbia Business School. How come you chose to get an MBA and to enter the business world, given that you have a background in clinical psychology?
I caught the bug. I caught the dot-com bug in 2000. And with a couple of friends, raised money and moved to Bahrain and started a company there. And then it was pretty obvious that I didn't have the skills required. And so it was time for me to kind of think about what to do with my life and applied to business school. And one of the best decisions I think I've made.
What other ideas were you flirting with after you graduated from business school if you hadn't started The 99?
Actually, that's a good question. I'll tell you exactly what it was. In business school, I developed a concept called Sayyidina, which what the name of it eventually was. What it was is when my wife had our first child, in Kuwait, the women take these herbs. And so I went to get her these herbs from the guy who sells the herbs. And the guy had a cigarette between his fingers. And as he was spooning the herbs into a plastic bag, it was like, one part herb, two part cigarette ash, And I was like, I told her, I was like, you're not taking this. And of course, I lost that argument. But then I thought, if this was a branded product, would I have an issue? And so that's what I developed in business school, this idea of getting to the Islamic nutraceutical market. And what happened then is when the U.S. invaded Iraq, my business plan no longer became viable because the problem is that in the GCC, in the Gulf states, you can't just be kind of a marketing company that creates your product at somebody else's plant and white labels it. You actually have to have your plant there for them to come inspect. And the idea of raising money to create something in Kuwait during a war didn't make sense. And so that idea I didn't develop, but I'd already done all the research for, the quote-unquote Islamic market. And so when the idea of the 99 hit, I already had a business plan that I could kind of reform a little bit.
So the business plan for the 99 stemmed from your business plan for this nutraceutical company.
Yeah, go figure.
So how did the idea for the 99 originate?
I literally, 2 weeks out of business school, I was in London in a cab with my mother and my sister, and we were traveling from Edgware Road to Harrods. I like to say it's a pilgrimage every Kuwaiti must make once a lifetime. And
Harrods being the fancy department store.
Exactly. And on the way to Harrods, my sister, had wanted me to go back to writing. I had the stint in the mid-90s where I wrote and illustrated my own books that I intended for adults but got an award for children's literature. And so I never intended to write for kids, but that's how I was labeled. And so my sister wanted me to go back doing that. And I wanted her to shut up, but I couldn't do that. My mom's there. And so I just said, somehow for me to go back now, it's got to be something that one day could have the potential of Pokemon. With all these degrees, it doesn't make sense to go back to writing for kids. And so she shut up, and I started to free associate. I said Pokemon. My next thought was there had been a fatwa issued against Pokemon. It's not allowed in some countries back home. My next thought was, my God, what has happened to Islam, and who's making these random decisions for my children? My next thought was, was Allah and how disappointed he must be. My next thought was that Allah had 99 attributes. And ironically, it brought me full circle back to Pokemon, which is a concept of a few hundred attributes. Actually, now it's over 1,000 attributes. And I got out of the cab at Harrods, and I couldn't get out of my mind. It hit me. I didn't know it was going to be superheroes. I didn't know it was going to be comic. I didn't know any of that. But I knew this was the concept. This was going to be the way to reclaim kind of what Islam has become to mean.
You mentioned shut up a few times to your sister. What kind of relationship do you have with your sister?
I have a great relationship with her, which is why I couldn't say shut up. I had to be nice about it. Yeah.
Okay. So you have this eureka moment to create this superheroes series in an effort to reframe Islam for Muslims. Why is there this negative view of Islam among Muslims? When did that develop? Because when Islam was first founded, it was taught in a more positive light. So when did this shift happen?
I mean, every religion goes through this. You know, if, you know, 1400, in the 1400s, you know, Catholics were pouring hot lead down the throats of Muslims and Jews to get them to convert. So I think, you know, they say power corrupts and absolute power, you know, corrupts absolutely. And in the wrong hands, even a piece of paper can be dangerous. So I don't think it's, you know, something that is necessarily a part of Islam, but that's today, that's, you know, the most poignant example of the negative views of the messaging. And it just so happens that this stuff is happening at a time in which technology is so advanced that, you know, when there's a suicide thing going on, you can take out dozens if not hundreds of people versus the one or two people you could take out in the 1400s.
So your sense is that this conflict within the religion is a natural course of evolution. It happens in every religion?
I believe so. And I think it was arts and culture that took down, you know, the fundamentalism of the Catholic Church back during the Renaissance. And, you know, when all of a sudden you could have different opinions of the same thing. And see, the thing is, when you think about kind of arts and culture in the Islamic world, you're talking about 1,000 years where the only representation of art was calligraphy. It was actually the writings from the Holy Book. And so, you know, I had ran a little experiment with one of my sons, and I showed him a picture of the Mona Lisa on the internet. And I said, "What do you think of this?" And he said, "I like it, but I don't like the colors, you don't like the smile." And then I showed him a piece of art up on our wall, which is literally a piece of the Quran. And I said, "What do you think of this piece of art?" And he just didn't say anything. And I said, "What's wrong? You gave me the opinion on the Mona Lisa. Why don't you give me the opinion on this?" He said, "It's the Quran. Of course it's beautiful." But you see, the point I'm trying to make is that even the expression and interpretation and opinion about art was held by religion. What are you going to say? The font is too small? I don't like the color purple? There's very finite in terms of the views you can express towards the art.
Out of fear?
Well, because, yeah, I mean, what are people going to think? This is really me, you know, so...
You're afraid to really express your opinion.
Yeah, yeah. I believe strongly that God doesn't need a middleman. And that, you know, the idea of letting a small group of people kind of control the message is the problem that we have today in the Muslim world.
What is the way out of this? The 99 is an effort to improve people's self-perception by using archetypes from Islamic culture. Do you see art and entertainment as that vehicle?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I'm somebody who believes that, you know, the show 24 is one of the reasons we have President Obama in power. I mean, if you think about it, we had I think it was 5 seasons, 2 with, you know, bad and corrupted white presidents, 2 with very positive African-American presidents. And actually, I had the opportunity to ask one of the producers at the Library of Alexandria in a panel. I said, you know, I believe you put President Obama in power. And I think you could have also made the kind of a very major impact on getting the first female president. But she, in the end, she did the wrong thing. You know, and then he wouldn't comment on that.
Have been Hillary Clinton.
Could have been, but I really think that art, you know, that's the only way to kind of get a mass media message. I mean, think about what the Cosby Show did for African Americans in the U.S. It's aspirational in the sense that you send a message to the population that's intended for, saying this is what you could become like. But it's also aspirational for people who are not part of the population to kind of try to normalize and mainstream elements that they wouldn't otherwise want to normalize.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Naif Al-Mutawa, the founder of the comic series, The 99. The series includes comic books, a theme park in Kuwait, and a TV series. The 99 is based on Allah's 99 attributes described in the Quran, and the goal of the series is to provide youth in the Arab world with peacemaking role models. Naif is a psychologist who founded the comic series in 2003. Even though you grew up in Kuwait, you spent a good deal of time in the United States. In addition to college at Tufts and graduate school, you went to camp in New Hampshire. How did you end up in camp in New Hampshire?
You know, it's actually, ironically, it's a Jewish summer camp. It's probably Jewish. And my parents didn't know, and I never told them. I didn't actually realize it until my 7th year there. I went for 10. And the biggest hint should have been that I was the only one that kept kosher.
In your family?
In the camp. But my kids actually now go to that camp.
What's it called?
Camp Robin Hood. It's in Freedom, New Hampshire. But you know, I chose it out of a book on camps. It was the summer of 79, and you know, Mrs. Poole, my second grade teacher, had this book of camps, and my parents wanted me to improve my English, and I liked Robin Hood, and I just chose Robin Hood. And
What did your parents do?
My dad's an investor, and my mom is a philosophy teacher.
And they were fine with your going to the United States for camp?
They chose it. They sent me. My mom actually didn't see it until like the 90s. I got there for 10 years. She had no idea where I was going.
That's funny. You didn't realize that most of the campers were Jewish until your seventh year. When did that strike you?
It was kind of, you know, it was back during the oil tanker crisis in the Gulf in 87. And there were, we're teenagers and people expressing political opinions for the first time. And I kind of realized I was outnumbered in my opinion. But I mean, the thing is that I never felt out of place there. I was treated with such respect and dignity and really a very important part of my life.
What about religion in your life? You are Muslim.
I am.
How religious are you, and how religious were you growing up?
Growing up, I wasn't very religious. In fact, you know, Islam was taught to me in very black and white terms, and I don't do black and white. When I went to college, I was kind of like, this is it. I'm done pretending. And
meaning I'm done with the religion.
Yeah, I'm done. I'm done. You know, I'm not going to defend it. I'm not going to be a part of this. And then, you know, my head got turned to the very, very simple thing that happened. There's an imam who actually was doing his PhD at the Harvard Divinity School who came and spoke at Tufts. And he said this. He said, if you asked me if usury or taking interest was against religion, I'd tell you yes, and I'll quote you chapter and verse from the Quran. Then he said, but if I hadn't taken a loan and paid interest on it to buy my car, I couldn't be here today to talk to you about Islam. And that was kind of a big moment for me, because he showed me there was a gray area. And I was 19 years old, and I was like, okay, I can do this, I can do. And, you know, so you ask me, am I an observant? In my mind, I am. But to others, I'm not. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on kind of what yardstick you want to use.
So your sense was, if this imam can compromise and not have such a strict interpretation of the Quran, so can I and still be Muslim.
Exactly.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Naif Al-Mutawa, creator of The 99, a comic series. We'll hear more from Naif coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Naif Al-Mutawa, founder of The 99, a comic series with superheroes inspired by the Quran. The superheroes in The 99 were created with the intention of providing youth in the Muslim world with positive role models. Your mother tongue is Arabic.
Yes.
But you preferred to read in English.
Yes.
When you were a child. Why is that?
You know, I used to think it was because I didn't like reading in Arabic. And then when I was 26, I came home and had a copy of a book called Cities of Salt, written by an Arab named Abdurrahman Munif. And my mom saw the book in my hand and said, "You're Arab, he's Arab, how dare you put an English translator between the two of you?" Then she made me read it in English, and sorry, in Arabic. And then I started getting into more Arabic books, and I realized that the Arabic books I was really getting into weren't really allowed in Kuwait and Saudi and the Gulf. They were all banned. And so I started thinking, huh. You know, it's not because I didn't want to read the stuff in Arabic, because the stuff that could have captured my interest wasn't available to me. So I bought those books in Beirut and Cairo and London and New York.
So it wasn't because you were resisting your culture in any way. It was just that those materials were not available to you.
I think my culture was resisting me in a sense, because, one of the things I believe is that in the name of preserving culture, these censors are killing it. They're killing it because people who can actually make a contribution to the culture in the mother tongue are gravitating towards other languages because of lack of stuff that can actually interest them. So, for example, if I had grown up reading in Arabic, I would be writing in Arabic today.
But you didn't grow up reading in Arabic because the authorities are precluding some of these books from getting into the mainstream.
Yeah. So I can write in Arabic, but I can't write the way I write in English.
Why are the authorities such inhibiting forces? What messages do these books have, such as your books, Cities of Salt, that scares the authorities?
That book, I couldn't figure out what it was, why exactly. But it's, you know, it'll be weird stuff. Like, you know, the give you an example. Virgin Megastore got closed down in Kuwait for 3 weeks because of a paragraph in one of the books.
The 99 is a comic series with superheroes inspired by the Quran. But before we get to the 99, I want to talk about Western comics for a moment.
Sure.
What is the origin of Batman and Superman and Spider-Man?
Western comics pretty much follow a biblical archetype. You know, if you look at the superheroes like Batman and Superman and Spider-Man, all of them, like the prophets, are missing parents. And all of them, like the prophets, have a message delivered from above through a messenger. The prophets get it from God through Gabriel. But Peter Parker is sitting there in a library in Manhattan when the spider descends from above and gives him his message through a bite. It's a metaphor for Gabriel coming down with a message. Bruce Wayne is sitting in his bedroom when a bat flies over his head. Superman is not only sent from another planet or from the heavens, but he's sent in a pod very much like Moses was on the Nile to new parents. And you hear the voice of Jor-El, his father, saying to Earth, I have sent to you my only son.
And how do they compare to your superheroes?
So our superheroes are based on archetypes from the Quran. So, for example, you know, our main bad guy in the 99 is Rugal. Why Rugal? Because Abu Rugal, or father of Rugal, is the person that gave the king of Ethiopia directions to the Kaaba to destroy it back in the what's called the year of the elephant, which is the year the prophet, peace be upon him, was born. And according to the Quran, God sent birds with stones that stopped those elephants in their tracks. So if you, for example, so if you go back to the 99, for example, you have Rugal, who's intent on destroying what I feel is Islam. He's anti-modernization. He wants to control very fascist agenda. That's our main bad guy. And the 99 stop him, right? They're not birds, but they're superheroes. You know, the Bible is known as the greatest story ever told. The Quran is a pretty good story itself as well. It's been around for not as long, but, you know, 600 years less, but it's been around for a while. And so there are story elements in there that can be captured for positive storytelling that's more modern.
So you said, okay, I'm gonna start this company. What were the next steps? Where did you get the financing?
So I raised $7 million in my first round. $1 million came from my classmates in business school. And those investors are from the U.S., Mexico, China, Lebanon, Jordan. And half the money came from people who had invested in my foray in 2000.
In the dot-com company, which was an Ameritrade partner, an online trading company.
Yes.
Where did you go from there?
At the beginning, I struggled. Then I raised the money. Then I was like, oh, my God, now I feel like a charlatan. I have this money. I mean, I've never done this before. And I really kind of had a lot of self-doubt. And what I did is I hired some people who were part of Marvel when Marvel went public. I had somebody who was the head of marketing, somebody who was the publisher at the time, working with us out of New York. I had a tough time trying to kind of convince U.S. talent 2 years after 9/11 to get involved in this concept. And the way it was ultimately solved is we bought Cracked magazine. And we remember Cracked growing up. It was Matt's competitor, Mad magazine. But that was the way in which I was introduced to a lot of talent that wouldn't work with me otherwise.
Was through the acquisition of this magazine.
Yeah.
A comic magazine.
Yes.
You have five children, and at the time that you launched the 99, you were married and had children. How were you able to support your family?
Good question. I have five sons.
Okay.
At the time, I had three, and none of them were in school yet. So things weren't as demanding. And plus, I was on a scholarship to do my doctorate. And so I was getting paid by Kuwait. I had income, and I hadn't wrapped up the dissertation yet because my dissertation was on PTSD and
post-traumatic stress disorder.
And my subjects were part of the Kuwaiti military who I couldn't access anymore, and so I was able to kind of continue receiving my funding because it wasn't my fault, and so I was able to kind of make it work.
You were living in Kuwait when you started.
Yes.
Was your wife working at the time?
My wife doesn't work.
Was she supportive of the endeavor?
Yeah, she was. Thank God she was, because I couldn't do it without her. She's, you know, my confidant. Like, I, you know, because being an entrepreneur, there's a lot of ups and downs. And it's, you know, manic depression on steroids. Funding's supposed to come this month, doesn't come for a couple months. So, you know, she's able to kind of calm me and absorb me and be very, very supportive. I mean, I really could not do this without her.
How has the 99 been received by the Muslim world, or at least initially?
Initially, what I was prepared for is exactly what happened. You know, when you introduce a foreign body or a new body into your bloodstream, what happens? The white blood cells come out and fight. It doesn't matter if it's good for you, bad for you. It's different. It has to, you know, we have to kill it. And the same thing happens in the mind. When a new thought gets introduced, you know, people will kind of try to bury it. And so I had some resistance in the beginning. But I was prepared for it psychologically. And was able to kind of maneuver my way around it to the point in which when we did our financing the second round, we did it through an Islamic investment bank, and that kind of quieted down the criticism, but didn't affect our content. At the end of the day, I mean, our content has nobody's religion in it. It's like seeing the kosher sign on the jar or the food. It doesn't mean that, you know, non-Jews can't eat it, but it means that Jews can eat it too. And so that was the idea of kind of getting this bank behind us. It doesn't mean that this is just for Muslims, but it means that Muslims can watch this too. And it kind of it helped deal with the pushback.
Because they felt they were a part of it now.
Yeah.
What are some examples of the worst moments you've had in this process?
Between the first and second round of financing, the money was supposed to come in March. We were running out of cash around then. And management stopped taking their salaries. And then that wasn't enough. And so I took out a personal loan because I couldn't let the new investors know we were in that situation because they smell blood in the water. All of a sudden, you know, either they pull out or they try to renegotiate your valuation, right? So it was very tough.
How long did that last?
3 months. 3 months. And then we closed. And then, I got back the money I lent the company and was able to close out that loan. And obviously, I paid the interest personally. But I kept a straight face and I let my board know afterwards that I had done this. And it's one of those things where it's always better to ask for forgiveness than for permission. Another one is, you know, when we got stopped in Saudi, and that was really dependent on, our business model was really dependent on it. And so that was kind of like, oh my God, now what?
Why were you stopped in Saudi?
Our distributor was zealous. He was very excited about the project. So when he submitted the paperwork to the ministry there, he wrote between brackets, God's 99 names. And all of a sudden we're in a situation where they're trying to find where the subversive messaging was to do with religion. Of course, it's not there. We got put in a hole unfairly that we couldn't get out of for a while until we, you know, got that funding from the Islamic Bank.
Did they ultimately retract that?
Ultimately, it was weird. What was weird is that they allowed it in English and they allowed some of the issues in Arabic. Pretty soon, ultimately, there won't be any stopping it because it'll be on TV, it'll be on the internet. It's, you know, it will be there. It'll be seen. And the irony is that the biggest support I've had is from Saudi. Most, you know, more than half of my investors are related to Saudi in one way or another. My wife is Saudi. You know, my kids speak to me in Saudi dialects I don't understand sometimes. So, yeah.
What were some turning points for you with the 99 that helped it get recognition?
In terms of recognition, there's been two really important ones. One was I cornered a New York Times journalist back in December 2005 in Dubai at the Arab Thought Foundation, and I pitched him, even though I had no product yet. And he, you know, he interviewed me, and then he told me, you know, we'll release this article about you. But, you know, I was excited. You know, when he said, well, you know, it's Islam and cartoon is not a timely topic, so, you know, next week, next month, eventually. And what happened is a month later, I called him up. I said, Happy New Year. He said, thanks. We had a baby. I said, congratulations. You know, when's the article coming out? He said, oh, it's not timely. And a couple of days after that, the world erupts in the Danish cartoon controversy. And I became timely. And just luck. And, you know, a flurry of emails and phone calls to the New York Times. Next thing you know, it's a full page on January 22nd, 2006. And anybody Googling Islam and cartoon or Islam and comic trying to figure out what's going on in the world with the Danish cartoon controversy got me. And then the most recent is President Barack Obama's mentioning of the 99 and the crossover, which, you know, when I had the idea for the crossover, it was back in February 2009. I was having lunch with Paul Levitz, who was then the president of DC Comics. And so I went to him, I said, you know, Marvel pulled this quick, cheap shot that nobody saw coming on Inauguration Day because they had President Obama with Spider-Man on the cover of one of their magazines, and it became a big seller and because President Obama likes comics. I said, good for them, but you have the ability now and to fulfill President Obama's vision. And I pitched him a crossover between the 99 and the Justice League.
What's the Justice League?
The Justice League is Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman. They're called the Justice League of America, collectively. And so he loved it. We negotiated a deal. And then 2 weeks after the president spoke from Cairo, on July 2nd, DC Comics announced this crossover. And then the first book came out October 27th, 2010. And President Obama spoke about it in his speech. He called it the most innovative response to his Cairo speech. because he reached out to the Muslim world, and in return, the 99 reached right back out to the Justice League, to their American counterparts.
Through comic superheroes,
yeah.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Naif al-Mutawa, creator of The 99, a comic series that incorporates teachings from Islam. The superheroes in The 99 were created with the intention of providing youth in the Muslim world with positive role models, and the goal is to reframe Islam for Muslims. You also helped to launch the region's largest private mental health clinic based in Kuwait. When did you do that?
I went to one of my mentors in 2008, Dr. Jafar Babahani, somebody who for 25 years had been practicing psychology in Kuwait, not taking a dime from anybody because he could afford to, but also because he cared. And for the 15 years I knew him, he was trying to change the laws in Kuwait, because in Kuwait, it's not the Ministry of Health that regulates you as a psychologist, it's the Ministry of Commerce. And so people who have a degree will go open up a bodega and start seeing clients, and lots of quacks in the market. And, you know, I went to him and I said, Jafar, you know, I can help you change psychology in Kuwait, but it's going to be through a social business. It's not going to be through the governments. And the model I gave him was that of the Sultan Center in Kuwait. So the Sultan Center is like the most successful supermarket chain in Kuwait. And before they came into being, there were all these supermarkets that are, you know, owned by the government that were terrible. The shoes were being sold next to the apples, next to the shampoo, and it was just abysmal. But Sultan Center said, you know, they basically set up the nicest supermarket in Kuwait and forced all the other supermarkets to change or go out of business. And I said, that's the model I want to use. I want to set up the nicest clinic in Kuwait, have the best talent, and then you force these guys to go out of business. And that's exactly what happened.
You helped to launch this private mental health care clinic while you were working intensely on getting the 99 off the ground. What is the connective tissue between the two?
The only connective tissue for me was that it was an investment, and that they say if something can go wrong, it will go wrong. I got blindsided. My mentor passed away in the middle of the setup of it, and I found myself in the middle of another startup on my own, and it was one of the worst years of my life in terms of the amount of work. Obviously what had to give was not as much time with my family that year, and but it's up and running, and it's, in hindsight, it was probably not the smartest thing to do. Being an investor in something is fine. Being the investor in something when you're running something else, not very smart.
You wrote children's books in the 1990s.
Yes.
How did you develop an interest in writing?
I've always wanted to be a writer. I mean, I told my parents when I was 9 or 10 that I was going to be a writer when I grew up, and they said, that's a great hobby. You know, don't think about doing it for work. You know, back when I did these children's books, it was in response to somebody who had been fired because of their religion in Kuwait, and the guy that fired him gave out leaflets to the local community apologizing that had he known the guy's religion, he wouldn't have hired him to begin with.
What was the guy's religion?
I think he was Sikh, and so I was wondering what planet I just landed on after college, and I wrote and illustrated this book that I intended for adults. It was about what's going on in Rwanda and Yugoslavia at the time and this guy, but UNESCO recognized it with an award for kids literature. And I was like, oh my God, thank you, but kids. This wasn't meant for kids. But that led to a proper 3-book contract, because that book was self-published. I tried to find publishers in the region, and all of them were kind of, you know, they pay you $1,000 and keep the IP. But I didn't want to do that. And so I actually sold a real estate ad in this book, and that's how I got the financing and learned the business. So I wrote it, I illustrated it, I was involved in packaging it and distributing it, and I put like these little moving kiosks in different malls that my family were friends with the owners of the mall. So I'd stand there selling my book, kind of thing. And it was an interesting experience, and did that. Book one did well, book two got well. Did book two did well, book three got stopped, book four got stopped.
Because?
Because the ideas were threatening.
Because they were about religious toleration?
I never mentioned religion in the books. So in the first book, basically, it's about a land called Bouncy Land where everybody's round. In that society, they judge you based on two values, how high you bounce and how fast you roll. The main character is born as a half circle, can't do either, is ostracized, you know, his parents are ashamed. But at the end, there's a flood. And in a flood, if you're round, you can't control yourself. But he's half circle, so he's a boat. So he's able to save them one by one and forces society to reevaluate the importance of diversity.
I guess the seeds for, you know, children's literature were sown in the 1990s when you were writing these books for children by accident.
Yeah.
And little did you know that you'd be creating this series for children decades later.
I mean, I honestly thought that was my best idea. That was it, the bouncy stuff. But when the 99 hit, I mean, I came back. So I quit writing at 27, came back at 32, I say, armed with my 99 superheroes.
Is there evidence, at least anecdotally, of the impact that the 99 has had on
Yes.
altering the mindset among Muslim youth?
What I can tell you is this. The 99 has made it to all kinds of, you know, whether it's classes in schools. A professor at Tufts in philosophy came up to me. She's a professor from Dartmouth, came to me when I spoke at a Tufts event and said, you know, that she had just been at the University of Heidelberg where she had presented a paper on Kant and other people presented papers on other philosophers, you know, Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, but the opening paper was about the thinking behind the 99. In terms of kind of making a small dent in, you know, academic circles and therefore into kind of classes, you know, we certainly have seen the beginnings of that. But one of my favorite photographs, which I have on my computer, it's a madrasa out in South Asia where you have this guy with his long beard and these little girls wearing the hijab, all holding up copies of the 99 smiling, and the picture was sent to me. And that's the good news. The bad news is there were photocopies, so we didn't make any revenue on those. But it's getting there. It's getting there. Even if there's a chance to kind of gather evidence, I don't know how you do that. I mean, I just do kind of my part. And, the irony is I started off this company trying to get into the magic pill business, and hopefully we created a magic pill of sorts.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Naif Al-Muhtawa, creator of the 99. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, an institution that's dedicated to developing Africa's next generation of leaders. The school admits students from across Africa and is committed to encouraging graduates to stay in Africa. Fred founded African Leadership Academy in 2004 when he was 27 years old. He's a graduate of McAllister College in Minnesota and has an MBA from Stanford Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You lived in over four countries before you were 18 years old. Why did your family keep moving?
You see, Ghana had an excess supply of skilled labor. And so other countries in Africa, as they were developing, would come to Ghana to look for professionals like lawyers and teachers and doctors. And my dad was a magistrate and my mother was a teacher. So they were recruited by different countries in Africa to come and work in their civil service. So that's how we moved around.
You did your primary and secondary schooling in Africa, and then you went to McAllister College in Minnesota. What was the thinking behind that?
My mother had been to graduate school in Minnesota, and so when I was growing up, I used to look at pictures in her album, and I would see pictures of her, you know, in the snow. McAllister is also known in Ghana and Africa because that's where Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, went to college.
Did you have the intention of definitely returning, or was there part of you that thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll stay put in the United States?
No, you see, one thing that all these experiences of living and working in different parts of Africa did is it made me very passionate about being an African. Mm-hmm. So most people who grew up in Africa only know the country that they were born in. In fact, their perceptions of the rest of the continent is what they see on CNN. I had seen that there was tremendous beauty in Africa and tremendous potential, that we were really the next frontier of development.
What did you think were the key ingredients to helping with Africa's development?
When I look at the history of Africa, we've been through different phases of development. You had the period in the 60s, which was the independence era. You know, African countries breaking away from the shackles of colonialism and gaining their political independence. And then you moved into phase two, which was the period of real political instability. Then phase three, which is more stability. and there's more semblance of democracy. And when, you know, a change of government happens by force, it's seen as an exception now rather than the rule it was 20 years ago. The thing that's left to be done in Africa now, I believe, and this was my perception when I was graduating from McAllister College, was to create prosperity and to eradicate poverty. So the first job I got out of college was with McKinsey, mm-hmm. the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand business. I wanted to see how business was being done in Africa. And that was how I began my journey of understanding what we needed to do to bring this next phase of change to Africa.
There have only been like a handful of leaders that have helped to transform African society, ranging from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Desmond Tutu. Why do you think Africa has kind of such a scarcity of leadership?
You see, when Ghana got independence in 1957, there was something like 18,000 university graduates in the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, if you exclude South Africa from the picture. Countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, had 4 university graduates in 1957. So imagine the independence era arriving in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. When Kenneth Kaunda was forming his cabinet in Zambia, you know, he had 4 university graduates to work with. And so that's the state at which Africans found themselves in the first set of leaders who took over the continent.
Your mother started a school in Botswana, and you, at age 18, became the headmaster of that school. Why did you become the headmaster of the school?
My mother was a really great teacher. And so the parents approached her and said, you know, would she set up a school for them? But she had no experience raising money. My dad had just passed away.
He died of high blood pressure and hypertension. Basically had a heart attack, yeah.
So she didn't have any financial resource of her own, and she had to look after 4 kids. So she said, look, I can't quit my job as a teacher and start the school for you. What I will do is I'll start a study group. And then it grew, more and more kids came, and then the next thing was 20 kids and then 25 kids. And then I had finished high school, and I had a year to wait before I went to college. And so my mother said, you know, why don't you run the school for me? And so for a year, I was the headmaster. I taught some classes. I managed some of the teachers and dealt with the parents. And I in the afternoons, I'd go and meet with her, and we'd discuss the strategy for the next day. And today, that school is one of the top-performing primary schools in Botswana.
And it's called Mount Pleasant English Medium School.
Exactly, and it has about 300 children.
Did you think, you know, during that year that, you know what, I'd like to make a career out of being the headmaster of a school?
Absolutely not. I had no idea that one day I'd be back in education and in leadership development. You know, I saw my future as a businessman.
So here you were. You were at McKinsey, and then you decided to go to Stanford Business School. And McKinsey paid for your education at Stanford Business School, about $125,000. And you were supposed to return to McKinsey, but instead you decided to start African Leadership Academy. What was the catalyst for saying, you know what, there is a scarcity of leaders in Africa, I'm going to start ALA rather than return to McKinsey?
So in between my first and second year at Stanford, as most MBA students do, I had to find an internship. Given that I was supposed to go back to McKinsey after my MBA was finished, I thought, let me just do something interesting. So there was an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria to help set up a microfinance institution. Mm-hmm. And I went to Nigeria, and in the course of that, I met these wealthy families who were complaining to me about the fees they were paying to send their, you know, children to expensive boarding schools in the UK. They were paying about $50,000 a year to send them there. So I was thinking, wow, why are we paying so much money to send young people to these schools in the UK? Why don't we have the best education institutions in Africa that can keep them on the continent? Because I was worried that these young people that were leaving were the future leaders of Africa. So that's when the light bulb went off, and I said, you know, why don't I actually build this institution? And so I said, you know what, I need to find a way to pay this $120,000 off to McKinsey and really do this. I didn't know where I was going to get the $120,000 from, but when I graduated, I called McKinsey and said, you know, I'm not coming back.
How did you raise the $120,000 to pay them back?
I had borrowed some money from my mom, mm-hmm. And then also I had raised some money to start ALA from my friends and family, and part of that was the salary I was going to pay myself. And so what I did is I took the salary that I was going to pay myself and gave it to McKinsey.
Mm-hmm. So,
and so then I had no salary to live on for the next 2 years.
And where were you living at the time?
In Johannesburg.
So what was it like having no salary? What did that mean daily?
It meant daily I didn't know where my meals were going to come from, where I would get money to buy clothes from, and you know, other basic things that people who have a salary take for granted. So I had to become creative in terms of the way I lived. My friends would buy me lunch. You know, so I made sure that I always had a lunch appointment with a friend.
Uh-huh. Where did you live?
I slept on people's couches and, you know, friends' cottages in the backyards, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things.
Your mother, as we discussed, was an educator. What was her perspective?
She thought I was crazy, even though she had done it herself. She hadn't done it, I guess, in such a risky manner.
Her name's Edna, and she eventually gave you $100,000, which, by the way, have you given back to her, or was it more of a gift?
Well, it's something I was meant to pay back, but I think over time she's forgiven the loan.
Ah, it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly.
I see. So here you are sleeping on friends' couches and having people buy you lunch. Was there one or two people in the early days that really helped to, you know, get the academy off the ground or to make the idea of the academy more of a reality?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they were my partners, my co-founders. You know, one was a man called Chris Bradford, who I had met when I was at business school, and then my two former bosses from McKinsey. Mm-hmm. We initially raised about $200,000.
And then you were looking to raise $7 million, and the bulk of that came from a woman named Rebecca Capizio. Why was Rebecca interested in African Leadership Academy?
We set out on a search for a possible campus. And we went to this area just outside of Johannesburg called the Cradle of Humankind, which is where some of the oldest human remains have been found. It's a very beautiful setting. And there was a conference center there that we approached and said, you know, can we rent this conference center and use it for our academy? And they said, you know, sorry, we're fully utilized, but why don't you go next door? There's a property there. There was a manager at the farmhouse, and we kind of shared what we were trying to do. And he said, you know, we don't have a space there that's big enough for you to use for the campus, but the owner of this property is very interested in education. Hmm. So why don't you send us something and we'll send it to the manager, to the owner. And we didn't know that the owner was this woman, Rebecca Capizio, who comes from the Oppenheimer family that owns De Beers in South Africa.
De Beers, the Diamond Empire.
The Diamond Empire, exactly. So we sent her a one-page description of what we were trying to do, and she wrote back and said, you know what, I don't have a facility that you can use, but I like this idea so much that I'm willing to build it for you.
Huh.
And we thought, wow, does she really know who we are? I mean, just from a paragraph, she's willing to commit. You know, does she know how much money we would need? So then we said, you know, okay, we're coming to Seattle in a few weeks. Can we come and meet with you?
Because she was living in Seattle at the time.
Exactly. That's why she wasn't at her property when we visited. Mm-hmm. And so we went and met with her, and you know, we said, look, this is going to cost us about $5 million to build it. Are you willing to commit this money? And she said, yeah. And that changed everything.
Do you remember that specific moment? Were you in her house when she talked to you about it?
We're sitting in a lobby in a hotel in Seattle, and she had come with her husband, and I was there with Chris. When we met her, it was kind of a surreal experience. You know, we were these 27-year-old guys with just an idea on a piece of paper.
Incidentally, in addition to Rebecca Capizio, another woman was pretty instrumental to you in the early days, and that was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, mm-hmm. who had gone to high school randomly in Ghana. Mm-hmm. How did she help you?
At this time, I didn't know how to raise money. I had been to visit the dean at the Stanford Business School to ask him for advice on how to raise money. And one of his pieces of advice to me was that you should never ask for money in your first meeting with someone. So this is our first meeting with Carly Fiorina. And, you know, we had lunch with her, and then at the end she said, okay, so why did you want to meet with me today?
Mm. And meanwhile, you have his advice in your ear.
I had his advice in my ear. I said, don't ask her for money. So I said, well, you know, perhaps you could help us with your relationships in the technology world to help us get some computers for our school. And he said, okay, fine, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, maybe you could also help us build relationships with the South African government. And she said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, is there anything else? And so at this point, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she she's asking us if we need money. But the dean of Stanford said, don't ask for money on your first meeting. So Chris is kicking me under the table saying, So then eventually I was like, well, we're also looking to raise money and, perhaps you could contribute. 3 months later, she gave us $100,000.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. How did you encourage applicants? How did you encourage people to come?
We had, surveyed parents. We had talked to headmasters of other schools in Africa, had asked them about the concept that we were proposing. And, the feedback was generally quite positive. But we had never actually spoken to young people. And if you think about it, they were the client base, the customers, in a way. So 2007, we said, we're opening our doors a year from now. We need to start recruiting our first class. So we hired a team of people, and we went around and started visiting schools. And we did a mailing to about 2,000 schools. And we were shocked when the deadline arrived and we had received 1,700 applications from 35 countries for our first class. And there were only 100 places available.
Who were some students who really impressed you? You're like, wow, I want this student in my school.
One of the things we asked in the application form, we said, tell us about a time you identified a need in your community, mm-hmm. and what did you do about it? And so Belinda's application, she talked about how she was she lived in a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And every day she used to see these three kids coming around and begging for food. And so she approached them and to find out why they were begging, and it turned out that their parents had died from AIDS. And so she decided that she wanted to do something about this to help them so they could stop begging. And she had been learning agriculture at school and was learning how to raise chickens. So she asked her mom for, about a couple of dollars and used that to buy a couple of chickens that could lay eggs. And she built this chicken business. And with that, she was able to generate enough income that she was able to feed this family of three, these three kids. And then she taught the kids how to look after the chickens and also how to grow a vegetable farm and so on. And soon they were able to look after themselves completely independently, and they were able to have enough funding that the oldest child could now go to school. And she did all this by herself when she was 16, 17.
You created from the start a financial incentive for your graduates to stay put in Africa. How does that work?
The vast majority of the young people that we admit to the academy cannot afford to pay the fees. So we give them scholarships. It costs about $25,000 per child for 1 year. We don't give them that scholarship as a grant, but as a forgivable loan. And so when they graduate from the two-year program and go into college, that loan continues accruing interest. So all we ask is that they return to Africa by the age of 25 and stay and serve the continent for 10 years. They can do whatever they want to do in Africa. And if they don't return, or they leave at some point before they're 10 years old, then they have to repay that loan with interest. Mm-hmm. There's a model like this in Singapore and in Thailand. There's a school called Raffles Junior College, and they have a 97% return rate.
African Leadership Academy aims to develop the next generation of leaders. What does that mean practically or daily?
A big part of this development is what we call giving them practice in leadership. So while they're at the academy, they all have to do what's called a culminating project, where they either have to launch a business or launch a social venture in the community. And what we're trying to do there is to simulate the kind of experience that Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room at Harvard when he started Facebook. So over the last few years, we've launched about 42 different ventures, ranging from a bank that operates on our campus to a farm on the campus to a clothing store to sustainable community agricultural projects that have all been spearheaded by these young people. And we have a venture fund on our campus that invests in them. And aim there is to really give them the taste of being an entrepreneur and being a leader in real time and real life. And we believe that if you give them this defining experience at that age, it gives them the foundation and the passion to go on and do entrepreneurial ventures and to be leaders on a much bigger scale later on in their lives. If I hadn't had this experience when I was 18, running my mother's school, I don't think I would have had the confidence or the experience to one day do what I'm doing today with ALA, which is on a much bigger scale. And if you look back, a lot of entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, when he was 15, 16, was selling magazines And that prepared him to go and launch Virgin one day. And so it's the same kind of practice and leadership that we like, that we spend a lot of time trying to give these young leaders. And then the other thing we're doing is exposing them to a network of mentors and potential advisors and people who can open doors for them as they go through different stages of their lives.
So what's an example?
There's a young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a refugee. He came to ALA on a scholarship, and while he was there, we had a guest speaker who visited campus. And this woman is involved in using theater as a way to help victims of trauma. Joseph was so struck by her talk that he said, you know, I really want to go and replicate this in my refugee camp. And in the process, the woman also got so involved that she helped him raise $20,000, and he used that to build the first high school in his refugee camp. And that's all happened because of that network that was struck, that conversation that happened when this woman visited campus to be a speaker.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is fromscratchradio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.